This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hello, I'm Dorian Linsky. Welcome to The Bunker Daily, where we talk to interesting people about the state we're in. There's a new episode every Monday, Tuesday, Thursday and Friday, and the main Bunker podcast comes out on Wednesday mornings. So subscribe, and we will keep going for the foreseeable future, 5 days a week. We live in dystopian times. A lot of people are currently turning to fiction about dreadful scenarios, perhaps to remind themselves that things could be worse. Having written a book about George Orwell in 1984, I know the territory well, and so does my guest. Naomi Alderman is the author of five novels, most recently The Power, which won the Bailey Women's Prize for Fiction, was one of Barack Obama's favourite books of 2017, and is set to become a TV show. Hi, Naomi. Thanks for joining me.
Hello. Lovely to be here. Yes, it is set to become a TV show whenever we're allowed to start shooting it again.
Were you in pre-production at the time?
We were shooting.
Yes, I know.
I drew the short straw. Yes, we were about 3 weeks into shooting, and I think it was not even maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago, we were still sort of having conversations about whether we'd be able to go on to the next part of the shoot. And we were just like, well, we'll have to just be careful, you know, and events, dear boy, as they say.
What's your role on the show?
Right. Well, I am sort of officially the showrunner. I've written the pilot episode. I'm working with a team of very brilliant writers who are writing it as well. I'm an executive producer. I'm overseeing some of it. I mean, yeah, it's been quite a full on interesting experience. Yes, and also when the apocalypse happened. I was in the middle of writing a new novel about a global pandemic.
No.
So that's interesting. I think it might be possible to rescue this novel, but probably the first third of it will just be able to be replaced by a single sentence now, because I won't have to explain to people what a global pandemic is, you know, or explain what the implications of that would be in the modern world. So it's interesting times right now. Isn't it, for all of us?
So I'm going to cast the net wide in this chat and sort of talk about all kinds of relevant fiction, not worry too much about kind of genre tags. I've got Camus' The Plague by my bed, which I can handle, but I don't have the stomach for Cormac McCarthy's The Road.
Which is
too bleak.
I read The Road whilst I had a fever. Not recently,
right, yeah.
Many years ago. And I can highly recommend not doing that. That is a bleak book, I would say. I am in a certain way an author of post-apocalyptic fiction myself, because I co-created and I write this game called Zombies Run, which takes place after a zombie apocalypse. And one of the things that I really object to in The Road is the sort of the assumption baked into it somewhere that quite a lot of people are really just waiting for an apocalypse to turn to cannibalism. I feel like that is a strong theme in certain post-apocalyptic novels, that if everything were to go to shit, the first thing some of us would want to do would just be to eat other people, and the rest of us would instantly fall victim to them, and there would be these terrible bands of marauders. And certainly The Road seems to me not only bleak about the environment, which there might be some cause to be bleak about, but also bleak about human nature, which it seems to me there's less cause to be bleak. So, yes, don't read The Road whilst you have a fever. I would say right now, don't read it at all. It's a very, very good book. I think I fundamentally disagree with its take on humanity. How about you, Dorian?
Well, another one that I kind of couldn't reread because it ends just too, it just howlingly bleak. It's Zone One, the Colson Whitehead.
Colson Whitehead.
Zombie,
yes.
One.
Zombies. Yes.
And obviously, this is not a genre which is famous for happy endings. But there are degrees of bleakness. Which kind of dark futures or alternative realities do you find tolerable? at a time like this, because obviously some people are just going to be like, "Look, I'm not reading anything remotely in this vein," but other people are drawn to it.
In this dark landscape, if you haven't read Station 11, you must instantly go and read it, because Station 11 starts with a pandemic, as we all do. It's a novel by Emily St. John Mandel, and it then goes on to talk about the people who are trying to keep culture alive after a very significant pandemic. Now, I must say, one of the nice things about Station 11 is to understand that there are many, many worse pandemics than the one we're currently going through. Many of us obviously, every death is a tragedy, and the lives we're living now is not particularly nice, but many of us are going to end up living through the most luxurious plague that humanity has ever experienced. So Station 11, it's a really hopeful book about, yes, there are some bad people, but also many people want to band together, want to keep culture alive, even in the face of an illness that were to kill 90 or 95% of people in the world, which we're absolutely not living through, thank goodness. Something will survive, which I find very comforting.
And there was some debate about whether, the power, how that is defined. I think in there's a Guardian piece, you go, is it dystopian? Well, only if you're a man. And the dystopia is a word that is just sort of, which I didn't realise until I was doing sort of book research, that basically nobody really used it until the 60s, and it didn't start to catch on in the 70s. And now it just means sort of everything. Any dark story that is not literally describing the world we currently live in.
Right. I mean, people also said to me that it was satire, The Power, which I was also very puzzled by, because I thought satire had to have an element of exaggeration to it, whereas I felt that The Power was a pretty realistic portrayal of what it's like to be a woman right now. I mean,
well, what was your first, the ones that sort of enthralled you when you were younger that would have, this sort of idea of exploring ideas and political, social ideas?
Oh, goodness me. Certainly I read a huge amount of Ursula Le Guin, who I can very strongly recommend. I also read a lot of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, actually, Douglas Adams, where that does start with the world exploding. And then you say, all right, well, after the world explodes, what then? Ursula Le Guin is particularly good at imagining societies that are very different to ours and societies in transition and change. There's a really interesting reason for that, Dorian, if you would bear with me for a little excursion into the world of Ursula Le Guin. All right. So Ursula Le Guin's brilliant books. There's a wonderful book called The Lathe of Heaven, which is sort of about a man whose dreams become reality, but I don't want to tell you any more than that, lest I spoil it. There's also The Dispossessed, which is a very, very good book about a breakaway society that tries to live on purely egalitarian grounds where nobody owns anything, and she really takes you into that society. There's also one of her most famous books is The Left Hand of Darkness, which is about a society with several different genders, which is quite a mind bender when you read it. She writes a lot about the people who are left out by different societies, and she's always very insistent on drawing our attention to the fact that every utopia is a dystopia for somebody. I am very interested by Ursula Le Guin and why she wrote like this. So in the early 19th century, a Native American man called Ishi came in from the wild, as it was described. And at the time, he was called the last wild Indian in newspapers at the time. He was part of the Yahi tribe, and he had spent many years visiting the different places where Yahi people settled. And in the end, having visited everywhere multiple times, he came to the conclusion that he was the last surviving member of the Yahi tribe, and that all the others had been massacred. So he allowed himself to be found, basically. And he was taken, it was in California, he was taken to a natural history museum in California, where he lived for several years with Alfred and Theodora Kraber, who were a husband and wife anthropology team, who wrote about Ishi, about the kind of person that he was, about what it was like for him to be the last of his people. There's a really devastating book about him that they wrote, which he was quite desperate to have some of the traditions of his culture be recorded. He loved spending time with children and showing them the traditional ways that he had learned to make tools and explaining his way of life to them. And but it was a very sad, lonely life because there was no other Yahi person for him to marry. He felt that he couldn't be in a relationship with anybody. And they talk about his feelings of sexual starvation. It's a story about the victims of the American utopian project. Mm. Anyway, Alfred and Theodora Kraber were the parents of Ursula Le Guin. And so she grew up in a house full of these ideas about who is left out of every utopia. Every utopia is a dystopia for somebody. And indeed, every dystopia is a utopia for someone. I mean, if you watch a film like Mad Max Fury Road, well, it's very nice for Immortan Joe and his mates, you know. There's always somebody benefiting and somebody not benefiting. So that's why I'm very insistent to say the power is only a dystopia if you're a man.
Well, what do you think? I mean, there used to be, you know, 130 years ago, there was a big trend for utopian novels, and that continued for some time. And for the last few decades, with a few exceptions, and Ursula Le Guin, obviously, mixes dystopian utopia. You know, people generally don't want to read utopian novels, but they love reading about terrible, terrible states. And, you know, you've got your kind of police state, I suppose, Orwellian school.
Yep.
And then you've got your the road school, where it's just like complete chaos and anarchy, and as we've discussed, people eating each other,
cannibalism. I'm sure that everybody who's experiencing COVID right now, or the COVID lockdown, is really battling with internal forces trying to tell them to eat other people. Anyway, sorry, Gary.
Why do, like, but this stuff is I mean, obviously you know these books are very successful, and films, and there seems to be an obsession with just awful scenarios. Yeah,
I have a few theories about this. I'm interested by thinking about when utopias came to an end. So in writing The Power, I did read a book by Edward Bulwer-Lytton called The Coming Race.
Yes,
which is which is about a utopian civilization in which the women have all mastered this power called Vril, which is a sort of electric power that means that you can do everything you could possibly want with it. And they sort of power things with their vril, and the use of vril has created a utopia. I suspect utopias died somewhere between 1914 and 1918. That's just my sort of finger in the wind, thinking about it, going, can I think of any significant utopias created after about 1920? Does seem to have, and I think
H.G. Wells was still going. He was still
I mean, was he writing utopias though?
H.G. Wells? He was, yeah. But he was, I mean,
yes, I suppose you needed to fun. You needed to believe that it was possible.
And
so this is the sort of famous postmodernist insight by Jean-François Lyotard, who notices that what happens across the 20th century is that increasingly people become very, very wary about grand narratives. So it used to be, in the year 1900, you could believe that communism really was going to fix everything. And then by the time in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, people started to really understand what Stalinism had been, people stopped being able to go, oh, yes, communism will definitely just fix everything. Similarly, there were feelings that maybe nationalism was the thing, but, you know, the First World War paid to that. There was an idea that science maybe could be the thing that would just drive humanity forward, and then we used it to make Zyklon B and gas chambers.
Yeah.
So I think the long 20th century was testing to destruction a lot of those ideas that we could just make everything brilliant. And maybe we've been rehearsing that ever since. Maybe it's time, though, for a resurgence of the utopia. I feel like I could do with one right now, but it would have to be problematized, wouldn't it? We would have to somehow understand that it will never be perfect.
And a lot of these kind of books, they are presented as sort of text in a way. I mean, the Handmaid's Tale has this kind of epilogue. It's like a document that's been discovered. You have some sort of epilogue in The Power, which kind of frames the text. And it's just like, is there a kind of desire to make it feel, particularly, you know, when you're sketching out things that might be improbable,
yeah,
or at least extreme, to make it feel as if, yes, this is a real document or recording.
I'll tell you what it is. I'll tell you what it is for me. I think it's many things, actually, that question. Am I allowed to swear on this podcast? Yes. Good.
Yes.
I think, certainly for me, I had a real sense of absolute fucking terror when I realised that the whole Roman civilization had been as sophisticated as ours and had just crumbled away into then several hundred years of misery and wretchedness as people forgot how to do all the things that the Romans had known how to do. That is a proper apocalyptic slow motion event of when you read Roman authors, which I did as a teenager, because that's the sort of teenager I was. when you read Roman authors and you feel the meeting of a mind that you feel in when you read a book, and you go, oh, you're funny, you know, or you understand that person. You can feel as if you have met them. And then you go, oh, and all of that you were part of just went away. And of course, this happens again and again through history. And when we discover that and when we really understand it, then we have to say to ourselves, well, what is going to be the end of my society? And will there then arise something in the future where people are reading my words or looking at this object that I own and trying to work out something about me from a far distant time? So I think what that sort of collage aspect is a recognition that our historical moment doesn't go to the edges of the page. Our historical moment is just one little stamp that someone's licked and put on a page that's already covered with a lot of other different stamps and stickers. And in order to really understand an apocalypse, you have to be able to say, and then that will be it for us. And then something else will come along. Somebody else will be trying to reconstitute what we did here. Yeah. So I think, I don't know, I've been watching the new Star Trek Picard, which, as a sort of side note, has a culture in it that arose and then vanished and left a message in a set of interesting in an interesting star system. And it's just a sort of given of science fiction that we understand that if we can look that far into the future, we can also look that far into the past and go, oh, crap. Every civilization before ours has thought there would not be a civilization ending event. And yet there has been. So what are we going to do about that?
Well,
When I brought up this idea of the podcast talking about sort of dystopian stuff and the kind of books and movies that people were turning to, you kind of mentioned something completely outside that category. The finding the time loops of Groundhog Day, which weirdly I did rewatch the other day, and Russian Doll, sort of relevant to this moment. Can you talk about that?
Yes. So, Groundhog Day, if I had to name a favourite film, it probably is my favourite film. I think it's a film about the meaning of life. And I've been thinking about it a lot recently because there is, I mean, I don't have to explain the whole film, right? But there's Phil Connors, Bill Murray's character, who is stuck in the same place and every day is the same. And he can't pursue any long-term ambitions. He's just every day it resets and resets and resets. And the joy of Groundhog Day, which I think applies to the same thing that I'm talking about with civilizations rising and falling, is that he manages in the end to find meaning and joy in the moments that, even though they don't have any long-term outcome. And I've been thinking a lot, as I've often thought, actually, about what it is that Bill Murray's character manages to do in Groundhog Day that ends up feeling meaningful. So he reads, he learns, he opens his heart to other people. He learns how to be more compassionate to the people around him. He tries to do something to help. And fundamentally, that does seem like pretty good advice right now.
He doesn't just sit there working his way through the 50 best shows to stream now.
No.
He learns to throw cards into a hat and play the piano.
He does. But he also tries to save the life of a homeless man.
Yeah.
And he ends up really finding out about the people around him. Now, obviously, that is more difficult if you can't touch them. But at the same time, it seems like allowing a sort of moment of not being able to go anywhere to really open you up to the people who are near you doesn't seem like a terrible idea.
Mm.
And then there's also the wonderful Russian Doll, which was made by Natasha Lyonne, which takes Groundhog Day on in an interesting way. I feel like I'm about to do a spoiler for Russian Doll.
Let me think. Well, basically, she does kind of, it starts, in the first episode, it shows that basically she just keeps reliving the same period.
Okay, I'm going to give us a spoiler. And if you don't want to hear that spoiler, listeners, just go on for a minute or two, wind forward, which is that it turns out there's somebody else trapped in the same time loop with her. And the end is that they have to somehow learn to care for one another. So there you go. I haven't given any actual plot spoilers, really. But that seemed to me to be address one of the questions in Groundhog Day that is sort of left hanging because he's just there by himself. So what would it have been like if he and Andy McDowell had to be sitting in the same fucking house for several months, getting on each other's nerves, the time like resetting for each of them every day? Mm. How do you love somebody through that? And I think Russian Doll is also quite an interesting thought about how we can possibly deal with the fact that the people around us are going to keep on doing that same irritating thing, and now we can't even go to the office to get away from them. I don't know. Just me. Maybe
yeah,
just
me. Yeah. No, I definitely feel every time I wake up in the morning, I hear "I got you, babe" in my head, and I think, how can I improve today?
Well, it's worth thinking it about once a week. How are you doing with making the days feel different?
They're quite repetitive.
Yeah.
But I like my family. That's nice.
Yeah, that's good.
But no, they are quite repetitive.
Yeah.
But by force. And what struck me here is that what is really unusual about scenarios is that sort of everybody, it's not quite every country in the world, but, you know, a vast proportion of the world is experiencing a version of this. Certainly huge parts of, you know, Europe and the Western world is experiencing the lockdown. And I do wonder what kind of art would be made about this when it's something that, in a sense, everybody knows. You're not doing what some people do, which is to sort of show you to go out and venture into sort of in extremis, whether it's sort of Orwell going, look, here is Stalinism and Nazism. You didn't live under it.
Mm.
You know, many people did, but, you know, showing it to people that didn't and going, this is what it was like. Nobody almost sort of needs to be told what this is like. Do you think that there will be a real struggle to create, obviously not your own novel, started before coronavirus, accepted, but do you think for people who are trying to write something about this period, that there will be a real struggle to find something new to tell readers or viewers and not just to sort of show them what they already remember?
I think there will be an initial struggle, but then I think there's been a struggle for a few years now for novelists because the news has been so unusually intense and almost as if some of it was directed by a reality TV star who used to have his own show where every week you had to have some exciting new thing happening. I think things like the Trump presidency and Brexit have been quite difficult because there hasn't been a solid ground to feel like, okay, I know what it means when I talk about a prime minister. I know what it means when I talk about Britain, if I'm writing about Britain. So, and I think there have been, I feel like I've seen novelists slightly flapping, trying to write about things very directly, which doesn't always work. But at the same time, I think this will be an epoch in life that there will always be different things to say about. So I'm thinking about Virginia Woolf writing after the First World War, writing about the First World War. There were many, many different stories to tell about the First World War. It had happened to a lot of the world, and yet not everybody had been in the same position. So you and I don't know what it's like to be a doctor right now. And in the future, I would really like to know. I don't really want to know right now. I think I will be very interested in drama about that once it's over. Right now, I want to give support to the real doctors rather than to see a fictional doctor. But I think at some point, I probably would like to see a fictional doctor. I probably would like to know what it's like to be in government right now. I probably would like to see a version of The Thick of It, which really talks about what's been happening in our government and other governments around the world. I'd like to know what it's like to be, I don't know, in a Welsh hill farm right now. Or I think also about, for example, people who are being abused by a domestic partner. That seems to me to be a peculiarly awful potential situation to be in right now. So I think it feels very big. And, I mean, obviously it is very big, but in terms of writing a novel or writing TV drama, writing any fiction, it feels like it's very, very close to your face right now. But I find that the process of writing is what moves the world into its own perspective for me. So for about 2 weeks, I said to myself, God, I can't write a novel about a pandemic now. And then this week I've been sitting down going, well, why don't I just try? And recently, in the past couple of days, I found myself writing as if the pandemic has happened and the world is on to the next thing. And that feels quite useful psychologically as well, to be going, okay, well, my novel is then going to be set during a different kind of pandemic in the future, but it will be one where people knew that this had happened and are remembering this. So,
yes, well, okay. I was thinking, you know, when I'm reading these novels, I think, well, the problem for the, and I've had this feeling reading War Diaries, Second World War Diaries as well, and it seems like an obvious point, but it's just like, these people don't know how it ends. They don't know, particularly in that kind of first half of the Second World War before the kind of tide turned. Mm. And there's that feeling of, and you know, I just felt like, oh, Jesus, it's, you know, I have the privilege of knowing how this ended. And what's very stressful about this current period is that we're in the middle. We're like the character in the novel that doesn't have the narrator or doesn't have the appendix or the footnotes or anything to say, and actually it turned out 6 months later, yada, yada. It's just like you're constantly in the middle of this huge event that you can't get your head around. So I imagine it must be quite therapeutic to sort of fictionally just sort of jump forward.
It's really, really nice. I mean, that's really one of the things that novels are for me, is to leave the present moment. That skill is extremely useful, because sometimes the present moment is really unpleasant.
Well, finally, I want to say, we've been talking about relevant novels, which sometimes means, you know, they can be heavy. And I wanted to ask you to sort of recommend some truly therapeutic reading. I found that I've finally got around to reading Marilyn Robinson's Gilead, and because it's a man that towards the end of his life, looking back on life with this sort of immense sort of kindness and empathy and a sense of peace. And it just felt like it created a mental space that I otherwise couldn't access. So that was my sort of like healing read.
Yes, that is a beautiful book.
When you don't want to read World War Z. So what would be your what would be your kind of like consoling read?
Okay, all right, I've got a few. I've been reading Dickens because you can just lose yourself in a Dickens. I've been reading David Copperfield, which I never read before, because the first few chapters are just so, so, so sad. But once you push through the very, very, very sad part where a child is having quite a lot of sad things happen to him, he's just great, Dickens. David Copperfield is great. It's a life's journey with its ups and its downs, and has been reminding me that this is not a new experience. Living in a world where people can suddenly die of a bad disease, that's part of human life. I could also recommend, in terms of books that create their own brilliant world, Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell by Susanna Clarke, which is another big fat book, which for me, that's quite appealing. And that's a beautiful, magical world that it creates. And finally, I have got for myself all of the volumes of Clive James's memoirs, which are just really, really funny. Clive James obviously died at the end of last year. And I remember reading a last interview with him where, you know, he wrote that brilliant poem about the Japanese maple that had been planted outside his house, and about how it felt to look at this tree that he knew would outlive him. And then, in fact, he outlived the tree, which is amazing. The tree died. But there was a wonderful interview with him, I think by Sam Leith, a last interview where he was asked, what do you regret? And he said, well, I'm just sad that I won't get to see the next bit. Whatever is coming, he was sort of, because he was somebody who was interested in the world. And I think to myself, well, this bit is the next bit that he missed. And
maybe he'd like to see the bit after the next bit.
Right.
The next bit.
Weirdly, for me, it gives me a sense of privilege to go, oh, okay, I'm living through the next interesting bit of human life. And all right, I wouldn't have chosen it, but here I am. And Clive James is just so, so funny. Yeah. And he's got these lovely memoirs about his time at university and about becoming part of the sort of media establishment. And as he said about himself, all he's ever had, or all he has, is the gift to turn a phrase until it catches the light, which is just, oh, fuck off for being so good, Clive James.
James always makes things better.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Naomi Alderman, author of The Power and showrunner the minute it gets going again of the TV
version. Pray for me. Or don't, if you don't believe in God.
Thanks for talking to me, Naomi.
It's been a joy.
And thanks to you for listening to The Bunker Daily. We'll have another episode on Monday. Remember to subscribe on Apple Podcasts or favourite us on Spotify. See you soon and take care.
The Bunker Daily was presented by Dorian Linsky and produced by Andrew Harrison. Jacob Archbold was the assistant producer, and audio production was by me, Alex Rees. The Bunker Daily is a Podmasters production.